Good mornings, I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, Findlay City Schools are the first in our area to return to class. Time for a reminder about the role we all play in back-to-school safety. Also this morning, the Humane Society recently took in more than a dozen dogs in an animal cruelty case. The process for rescuing abused and neglected animals is more complicated than you might think. College students heading back to class as well, and the number one school supply on their list is a good computer. Despite rising tech prices, there are deals to be found. And the Hancock County OSU Extension and 4-H programs are going full tilt, getting ready for the fair. Lauren Berner-Kitzler will tell us what's happening. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Wednesday, August 12th, 2026. Good to be back after a few extra days off. My wife and I just took a little weekend away, an extended weekend away to celebrate my birthday over the weekend. So good to be back, though. And I tell you, what's good, it's not so good for my mini vacation to be over. I mean, that's always a bummer, right? You have a little extra time off. You always hate going back and getting back into the swing of things, getting up early and all of that, not being able to sleep in, all that. But I'll tell you one thing that I am glad is over, and that is all of the storms from yesterday. My goodness, what a weather event that was. Not just in the state of Ohio, but all over this part of the Midwest, but especially in Ohio, there were all kinds of reports from all over the state. Sadly, at least three people were killed in yesterday's storms, two in Indiana and another person in Ohio. And did you hear that story in Grafton, which is Lorain County, southwest of Cleveland? 16 people were struck by lightning at a prison, the correctional institute there in Grafton, and had to be taken to local hospital. 16. Wow. Probably the most dramatic video that I saw, a couple of really dramatic videos that I saw of the storm damage from all across Ohio, was in Columbus, where high winds flipped a car on Interstate 71. Did you see that it was an ODOT highway camera that captured the moment? The car's just driving down the highway on Interstate 71 in Columbus, and now, I've seen winds topple like big semi-trucks or RVs, things like this. This is a regular car, not the type of vehicle you expect to get caught and flipped over in the wind. And it literally, the wind got like underneath of it and flipped it up in the air and over onto its hood. I don't think anyone was seriously injured in it. But can you imagine trying to explain that to your insurance company? And I wonder if the insurance will cover a new pair of pants that I'm sure the driver ruined in that incident. I mean, can you imagine being behind the wheel and all of a sudden your car is in the air flipping upside down? That's crazy. And then just this morning, I actually saw a video that someone posted also along Interstate 71 in Franklin County of some of the wind damage on the electric poles on the side of the highway. They were all bent over, not just the wooden poles, but the metal poles, the big steel electrical line poles bent over in half. That's some serious wind. Bend over steel poles. Just crazy. National Weather Service confirmed three tornadoes touched down near Chicago. They're going to look into whether there were any tornadoes in Ohio. It will be a while before we get the confirmation on that. But just crazy weather all over Ohio and really much of the Midwest. And so what do we have in the forecast today? More storms. Nothing like what we had yesterday. Not the intensity of the storm system that rumbled through the Buckeye State yesterday. But we are looking at the possibility of some more storms later on this afternoon. So buckle up. By the way, speaking of flying cars, did you see this story? Governor Ron DeSantis says that flying cars could soon become part of the skyline in Central Florida. By the end of the year, these flying cars could start operating in the region. The plan focuses on electric air taxis that can take off and land vertically, potentially offering a new way to get around the busy I-4 corridor from like the airport to Disney and the resort areas of Orlando. If you've ever driven down there, you know how crazy that traffic can be. And they think that these electric air taxis can relieve some of that traffic congestion. And I don't know if it's going to relieve the congestion. It's just going to take it to the air. That's officials still have to work through questions about safety, infrastructure, regulation, and cost. But they say by the end of the year, they could have flying cars in Central Florida. It's kind of crazy. And speaking of safety in the air, U.S. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy made an announcement on social media over the weekend. Maybe you heard about this. More than 2,000 video gamers have been hired as air traffic controllers by the FAA. I'm not sure if this makes you feel any safer in the air, but you know that there's been a shortage of air traffic controllers, so now they have hired a bunch of gamers. The agency launched a campaign earlier this year looking for the next generation of air traffic controllers that had qualities like problem-solving skills and multitasking abilities, and the FAA said the hiring was focused on reaching talented young people pursuing alternative career paths. They said several controllers pointed to gaming as an influence on their ability to think quickly, stay focused, and manage complexity. So as long as they realize that they're actually controlling real video or real airplanes and not, you know, video, this isn't a video game where, you know, if you crash a plane, you get another life. You know, and we're not shooting down aliens here. We're getting people to Disney where they can catch an air taxi, apparently. But, you know, but I hope it works. Let's see what else is going on. Among the first things that you need to know, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. Get your Wednesday morning started. So the saga involving the Dayton suburb of Beaver Creek and their ongoing spat with Buc-ee's continues to make headlines. Now, city council members in Beaver Creek say this is something that they should have done a long time ago, but now they are officially adopting the beaver as the city's official mascot. The vice mayor of the city of Beaver Creek says he loves how the town has come together after the national convenience store chain Buc-ee's sued a local shop, Beaver's Mini Mart, over the use of a beaver in its logo. And apparently city leaders were surprised that at no point in the entire history of the city have they had an official declaration of the beaver as the official mascot of the city of Beaver Creek. And so now they have passed such a resolution. Officials say the mascot resolution is not associated with the trademark lawsuit between Buc-ee's and Beaver's Mini Mart, but certainly that was the impetus inspiring them to do that. And the saga continues on that. Anyway, everybody getting their say. A couple of other items here, a couple of lists, and this is kind of interesting. A couple of lists. When was the last time you went out to eat? If you have, you have noticed over, no doubt you have noticed over the past several years, prices have been going up rather quickly and dramatically. Only four U.S. cities still offer a cheeseburger, fries, and drink for under $15 on average. Only four cities in the U.S. can you buy a cheeseburger, fries, and a drink for under $15. This is according to DoorDash and their latest State of Local Commerce report. In Austin, Texas, that particular combo is the cheapest, $12.94. In Laredo, they're number two, $13.39 is what you'd spend for a cheeseburger, fries, and a drink. Lincoln, Nebraska is at $13.86, and Detroit is just a hair under $15 at $14.99. So those are the four cities where you can get a cheeseburger, fries, and a drink for under $15. Now, when it comes to Ohio cities, Toledo, that combo will cost $17.07, which is a penny above Columbus's average of $17.06 and well above Cleveland's average of $15.96. That's the cheapest in Ohio. Cincinnati is Ohio's priciest city. It's $17.30, but Cincinnati did have one of the country's lowest rates of cheeseburger inflation at just 2.4%. So there is that. The average combo meal rose 3.2% over the past year, and at the opposite end of the spectrum, the opposite extreme, Anchorage, Alaska, averaged $28.28. Whew, man. Burgers getting expensive. And it's not just the food. I mean, it's everything. The cost of labor, the cost of electricity, the cost of, you know, everything and running a restaurant that plays into that. But it ain't cheap. It ain't cheap. And another list to share, and I love lists. I love lists. Gives us something to argue about. Football season right around the corner. And NFL preseason is underway. We'll get underway in earnest this week. NFL head coaches are getting a new preseason ranking on attractiveness. I love this list because usually when we talk about NFL head coaches, we talk about their record, we talk about their ability to manage, you know, NFL personalities and all of that, their effectiveness on the field. But no, this is an attractiveness ranking. This is from covers.com. Survey of more than 5,000 NFL fans ranked LA Rams coach Sean McVay as the most attractive NFL head coach. He's the most attractive. He was followed by Matt LaFleur from the Packers, and Seattle's Mike McDonald. Those are the most attractive NFL head coaches. Lions head coach Dan Campbell was 8th. Bengals top cat Zach Taylor was 22nd. And the Browns top dog Todd Monken was 29th out of 32. Now, they did note that the survey suggests winning and national exposure may influence how fans perceive their coach's attractiveness. Nearly 3 in 10 respondents chose their own team's coach as the league's most attractive. Although I'm pretty sure that wasn't the case in Cleveland. But interesting stuff there. We'll see if that translates to wins. The most attractive NFL head coaches. There you go, some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Wednesday morning started.
Start your weekday mornings at 6 with Chris Oaks and Good Mornings on 1330 WFIN and 95.5 FM.
So our cover story this morning, as we mentioned, Findlay City Schools be the first in our area to return to class. That being tomorrow, so that means this morning, we want to get a refresher about the role that we all play with respect to back-to-school safety. And Findlay Police Department Crime Prevention Officer Brian White is with us this morning. This is a familiar topic. We talk about this each year when the kids head back to class, but it is important because we've spent, you know, the past couple of months not having to worry about, you know, kids being out in the school zones and all of that. So we definitely want to make sure that we remember beginning tomorrow that they're out there and they're probably not looking out for us.
Yes. Good morning. Thanks for having me. Yeah. Whenever we're talking about back to school over the summer months, we kind of get a little lax, right? We're kind of in the summer mindset and we're not really looking for kids out and about, especially near the schools. And when we get to this point, it's like, oh man, there's kids all over the place. So yeah, it's a good time to kind of remind people, just about paying attention and being safe.
So first of all, let's remind folks about school bus safety and the requirements for stopping, you know, when the school bus is stopped and the lights are flashing and all of that. It's actually pretty simple.
Yeah. So what's going to happen is if you're driving down the road, the school buses, the bus driver, they are going to turn on their yellow amber lights. And that's just to give people an advance warning. Hey, we're getting ready to stop here. Right. So just like at a stoplight, yellow light means slow down. Right. Obviously, there's going to be a red light. And once they turn on their red lights and the stop sign comes out, we need to stop for the school bus. Now, that would be on a 2-lane road or a 3-lane road, much like on, say, South Blanchard Street. Mm-hmm. Where there's 3 lanes. In the bike lanes. If it's a 4-lane road, the only vehicles that are required to stop would be the ones that are in the same lane as the bus, right? So opposing traffic does not need to stop. And the reason being, kids are not going to be released across the road at a 4-lane road.
Yeah. Right?
They're going to be dropped off on that side of the road.
And then the requirement is to remain stopped until the bus starts rolling again. I mean, it doesn't really matter. Oh, okay. The kids are, you know, off the street now. I can go. They're going to wait for a couple of seconds, make sure that nothing unexpected happens. And then once the bus starts moving, that's when we can start moving.
That's correct. Yeah. Just because the kids have been picked up or they're walking into the bus.
Yeah.
Obviously, the bus driver is going to wait for them to sit down. Or they get off the bus, they're not going to remove the stop sign or turn off the lights until they are sure that everyone is safe.
So make sure that we are not ignoring those or worse yet, not even paying attention to them, because that is a big safety issue. And also with respect to school zones. Now, here again, I haven't had to worry about this for the summer, worried about the school zone speed limits and so on. And this applies regardless sure. of how that school zone is marked.
Sure. And this one gets confusing for a lot of people because generally with the signs you see during school hours, or it might say during school times, right? That doesn't really spell out the specific hours. And the reason why is because a lot of schools go to school at different times,
right?
Depending on what it's elementary, middle school or high school. And a lot of times these times might change from year to year. So you can't really put it up on a sign for this particular time. So the old adage is if there's kids present, slow down, pay attention, right? School speed limits are 20 miles an hour. And especially someone in a 35 zone, if they're traveling 40 miles an hour, they're already double that speed limit.
Right. And again, regardless of how the sign is, just some, I always bring up the case of Findlay High School. You go up Broad Avenue, Findlay High School, they've got the signs and the flashing lights and all of that. It's very clearly marked. You get a little further north on Broad Avenue, you get to Heritage Christian School. They don't have the lights. It's much more basic signage, but it's still the same thing.
Correct. Yeah, still the same thing. The state law only requires that there is a sign posted advising it's a school zone with a speed limit. A lot of times schools will put up the lights as an added measure to help people remind them and slow them down. Yeah, it's not really required to have lights. And sometimes you might see these lights flashing and there's no school, right, on a, say, holiday break or something.
Yeah. So,
yeah, you can't really just depend solely on the lights.
That's
you have to
point.
Follow the signs. And again, be a parent, be looking for the kids in the area.
Yeah. Before and after school, obviously, are the main times. But again, in the case of Findlay High School, kids going to be out during the lunch hour as well in many cases. So again, it's not just the before and after school times where you have to be mindful of this.
Correct. And that's where it gets frustrating for a lot of people, right? They want a specific time where I have to slow down or I can go the normal limit, but you just can't put a time frame on it because there is a lot of this transient drop off and pickup times, including maybe delays, right? So times kind of fluctuate.
Right. Yeah. So again, be mindful of that. And let's talk a little bit about, we get more of this obviously in the city schools than in the outlying areas, because everything else that we're talking about with school bus safety and the school zones and everything, that applies whether we're talking about in town or out in the rural areas of the county. But you see this more with respect to the city schools. You've got kids walking to school. You've got bike riders, at least in the first few weeks until things get really cold. Be mindful of these things. We tell our kids, don't run out in the middle of parked cars. Don't dart out. Look both ways before you cross the street. But the reality is, kids are kids. They've got other things on their mind, especially in those first few days of school. So we have to be extra vigilant on the road.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, kids will be kids, and we have to kind of expect them to do the unexpected, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of times you might see someone driving down the road and they just suddenly stop, right? Maybe you think they're pulling over, but really they're just waiting for a child to cross the street. And sometimes people want to go around that car, and that could create a bad situation, right, where we hit someone. So whenever we're in a school or even a residential area where buses are picking up kids, we have to make sure to pay attention. And really that goes for not just car drivers, but bicyclists, right? Kids riding to school, and pedestrians. It's really incumbent upon all of us to pay attention.
And what should the message be? What should we be telling our kids who are walking or riding bikes as parents? What are some of the things that we should make sure that we remind our kids about before they head off to school?
Yeah, well, like you already mentioned, right? Look both ways, right? Expect the unexpected. Make sure you're paying attention. Don't be playing on your phone. Those are a lot of the best tips that you can give, especially in a world that is filled with distractions. Really, most car crashes, most bicycle-related crashes, they usually come about because of some kind of distraction. And speed, whether or not it's someone on a bicycle just not slowing down, or whether or not someone in a car not slowing down. That plays a big part in a lot of these accidents as well.
And when we talk about drivers watching out for kids on the road, let's take a moment to talk about student drivers. You've got a high schooler that may be driving to school themselves for the first time. Again, all of these same rules apply to student drivers. And again, parents want to have that conversation with their new drivers.
That's correct. Yeah, if we're talking a brand new driver, there's a lot more restrictions put on them. Plus, a resulting crash could be very impactful on their driving ability, right? So yeah, we want to make sure to, again, have those same discussions, let them know, hey, you're driving to school, right? There's going to be a lot of kids walking, biking, everything else. You need to pay attention because you can't always rely on everyone else. Again, expect the unexpected. Expect that a bike is going to ride out in front of you. What are you going to do? Kind of get your mind in that headspace of, okay, I need to pay attention. I need to have an out, right? If someone does do this, I'm going to do this. Be thinking about this ahead of time.
Yeah. One other thing that I made a note of, and I meant to mention earlier, we were talking about school zones and a reminder about things that we haven't had to think about when we're behind the wheel. For anywhere near a school, a lot of those intersections will have no turn on red signs during school hours. So again, something we haven't had to worry about for the past couple of months, that now we need to be paying attention to these intersections where we can't turn right on red during school hours.
That's correct. Now, actually, most of the time, even during the summer months, I see people pull up to these intersections and are not turning on red because it's stuck and ingrained in their mind. Don't turn on red. Right. So, it can be an issue if someone's not paying attention. Right. Those no turn on red signs, usually they have some kind of time restriction on it. Right. During certain hours. That's one that usually does. But again, anytime that there's school in, that's when these signs are going to be in effect. And the whole purpose of this is to remove that one distraction of, right, I need to make a right-hand turn. I'm looking around both ways, and maybe there's kids crossing the street.
Right.
So it just kind of removes that.
Yeah. So again, all of these things that we have to keep in mind beginning tomorrow with the kids heading back to school. And it's not because, officers aren't out there necessarily looking to, you know, it's not a gotcha thing. The main purpose here, obviously, is to keep kids safe. That's what it's all about.
Yeah, and you'll probably see police patrol cars in school zones. And really, the main focus is slowing cars down, right? Yeah. Just that visual presence, kind of that visual reminder, oh, you know what, I need to slow down just for that purpose. But it really boils down to keeping kids safe. And another important thing to bring up is as we get into the later months of the year, it's going to be darker more often. So make sure kiddos are wearing kind of bright colored clothes, maybe a bright jacket. Something that sticks out, that way they're more visible when they're crossing the streets or on a bicycle.
And again, for us drivers, a special reminder that, yeah, you're right, as it gets darker, or it stays darker before sunrise, during the early morning hours, we want to be especially vigilant, because we've started to notice that already as well. Again, Findlay Police Department Crime Prevention Officer Brian White with some timely reminders for back to school. Safety is something that we all have a role to play in making sure the kids get there and get back safely. And Brian, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
You bet, Chris.
Well, I don't know if you heard about this story, but recently the Humane Society and SPCA of Hancock County took in more than a dozen dogs in an animal cruelty case. So that got us to wondering, and maybe you've wondered this too, what is the process for rescuing abused and neglected animals, and what happens to those animals after? Humane Society Operations Manager Natalie Reffitt is with us this morning. And first off, Natalie, I would imagine this is not something that anyone takes lightly. To seize someone's pet would be like taking away their child.
That's absolutely correct. It is something that we do not take lightly. We have to be very, you know, gentle with everybody involved.
Yeah.
Because sometimes there's just situations that happen. Sometimes, you know, people need resources that they didn't know existed. Mm-hmm. So it's very emotional.
Yeah.
For the person. It is.
And for the rescuers, pretty emotional, I would imagine, too. I'm assuming that most of the animals in your care came to the shelter either as strays or voluntary surrenders. How often do you get animals that have been removed from these types of unhealthy situations?
We actually get a decent amount. So 90% are strays, and then close to 90% are strays, but probably about 8 to 9% are the cruelty cases. And I know that percentage doesn't seem a lot, but for Hancock County, it is a lot.
Yeah. Still, I would hope that this case that we referenced from about a week ago or so was an extreme example. I mean, I don't want to dwell on it because that's not really the point here, but I would hope that this is not the kind of thing on this scale that you see very often.
We see it more than we would like.
Yeah.
We just don't typically speak about these things because, you know, we want to keep the privacy for the people, for the pets a fresh start. So.
Yeah. Like I said, we don't want to dwell on this, but it does raise the question of what is the process that has to be done or be gone through in order to remove an animal or animals from an abusive or neglectful environment.
So the first step, what gets us going is we receive a complaint. So someone calls, let's say that they say, oh, my neighbor had a dog. The dog is tied out 24/7. There's no food, water, shelter. So we would go investigate that complaint. Now, we do investigate in order of priority. So if there's another call that comes in that day that says, hey, I was over at my cousin's friend's house and I saw a dog in a crate. The crate was covered in feces and I could see the dog's ribs, that would be a higher priority.
Yeah.
if we knew that dog wasn't being fed versus the one outside that looked fed, even though they both need checked on,
yeah,
the higher priority needs to come first. So we would go over, we would try to make contact with the owner. And the first step is just a contact and information gathering. So we need to determine what is actually going on.
Yeah. And then what happens to the animals? I mean, assuming that this, you know, goes beyond just that initial contact and letting the owners know, hey, you have to take better care of your animals and maybe correcting a situation, that would be the ideal. But assuming that it goes beyond that and you do have a situation where an animal needs to be removed, what happens then? Is there ever a chance that they can be returned to a previous owner if a situation is corrected? Or is it a case that by the time they are taken, that they are removed, that usually it's a situation that's past the point of no return?
Now, that depends on the courts. So we can have input on that, but ultimately it's up to the courts if the people get their pets back. Sometimes people want their pets back. Sometimes the case has gone on, they mm-hmm. don't want the pets back. Sometimes they're not even able to have the pets back. So that really is case by case.
So this actually goes through the courts. Do you have to get a court order to remove an animal?
Sometimes we do, yes. Sometimes we don't need a court order. It just depends on if we have probable cause to go in to seize the animals. So it definitely depends, but there is a lot involved. We do communicate and work with local law enforcement, the courts, everything like that.
I would imagine that eventually many of these, or I would assume that eventually many of those animals are put up for adoption, but I also would guess that there is a litany of things that have to happen before they can be rehomed.
That is correct. So let's assume all the whole process has gone through and now we do have custody of the pets. So what happens is an intake process. We have to document with the medical team as well every pet and everything that is wrong or right with the pet. Mm-hmm. And then we do have to monitor them. So some of the pets are in different conditions. Mm-hmm. So some might need more medical care. Some might need more behavioral care. And by that, a lot of the times when we get cases like the Sheltie, when we have a large amount of animals from the same home, a lot of their behavior is they're very, very shy, very fearful. They really haven't had a big world. They really don't know what a leash is. They don't know what other people are. So we have to take time like that with them. Mm. And then, so they each have their own care plan. So as they're ready for adoption, then they become available for adoption. And also we're very lucky to work with, you know, rescues and other organizations. So sometimes all the pets aren't up for adoption because some rescues have stepped in and helped.
I was going to say, I'm sure that there are cases where an animal cannot be put up for adoption. So what happens then?
Yes, that is true. So that's where a lot of the rescues come into play. Other organizations that help us out. And unfortunately, sometimes if the medical team determines that, you know, the pet is kind of, you know, dying, then we would have to make that decision to humanely euthanize.
Yeah, but I'm sure that that's the last resort.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So yes, that is absolutely the last resort. So yes, they will be put up for adoption. They will be placed with rescues or foster. We do love our foster.
Yeah.
Family, so they would also go to foster.
And as you were mentioning, and you know, every case is going to be different, but on average, how long does this whole process take from, you know, learning about an animal that is in distress that needs help to, in a perfect world, rehoming that animal? I mean, are we talking, you know, a month, 2 months? What, you know, what kind of time frame does this usually take?
We're talking probably 6 months.
Wow.
Sometimes close to a year. Hmm. But if the owner signs off, like releasing, then it can be much quicker. Hmm. But if the owner does not sign over ownership, but we still have possession, it still has to go through the court, so it can take a long time.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, because we all want, you know, animals to be safe and healthy, what should people do if they believe there to be a case of animal cruelty or neglect? As you mentioned, that's what gets these cases started. Who do they call? How do we start the ball rolling if we know that there's an animal that needs help?
Yes. So you just call the shelter at 419-423-1664. You ask to be put through to animal control. So you will get to talk to animal control, or you might have to leave them a message and then just let them know what you suspect. If you leave your name and phone number, you don't have to leave your full name, but if you leave your phone number, that way we can contact you and ask some questions if we need to. Now, if you leave all the information, like the address, you know, yeah, of the person you're complaining about, we can go investigate. But if we don't have all that information, we're not able to. And if we don't have a contact number for you, then we wouldn't be able to, you know, go and start the process.
Yeah.
And then also sometimes people expect that we might call them and like give updates. Unfortunately, we do not do that. We will only contact the reporter if we have some follow-up questions, but it's not to give out details of what's happening.
Yeah. Again, Humane Society Operations Manager Natalie Reffitt with us this morning, kind of breaking down this whole process. Natalie, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Obviously, we have been talking about back to school for a few weeks now on the K-12 side. Want to take a moment this morning to speak to students who are heading off to college. The number one back to school supply for college students is a good computer, good laptop. And that is something that can be a significant expense, even more so today, given how rising demand for processors and memory chips have impacted consumer prices for tech across the board. So joining us this morning with some advice on getting the biggest bang for our buck is Colleen Novielli, Apple Director of Mac Product Marketing. And by the way, Colleen, we should also mention this is not just students, educators will be shopping for some of this stuff as well. So what features should we prioritize when we are choosing a device?
You really want to think about what is the student going to be doing day to day. And so some of the things that become important are potentially portability. Think about walking from your dorm room to classes and all over campus, and maybe battery life if you're going to be away from your dorm room all day. In addition, most students are thinking about the performance needs that they're going to have in order to fit their major. And so some majors, like things in STEM, maybe in 3D modeling, other professions like architecture, may have more compute-heavy needs. And so all of those things are going to factor in to your day-to-day considerations. Now, when you're ready to decide, come on into an Apple retail store. We know that many students, even if they end up purchasing online, they like to come into a store and really touch and feel the products, see the differences, and compare models. And we have Apple specialists who are here to meet with you, to understand your needs, and really help choose the exact product that's right for you. Now, we have Mac and iPad, and many students are choosing between those. And we have incredible products across both of those product lines that really have the combination of all the features we just talked about. And in addition, they work wonderfully with your iPhone, so students can seamlessly move between their devices throughout their day.
You know, the other thing is we are so conditioned these days to think of tech as disposable. You know, we get a new phone every couple of years. We want to upgrade our computers to the latest and greatest every few years as well. Is it possible to get a device that will last for a long time, I mean, through school and beyond. What advice would you have, especially for first-time buyers looking to make a single purchase that will last throughout a student's academic journey and maybe even beyond?
You want to think about the purchase as an investment that's going to take you through potentially your college journey and afterwards. We know a lot of students tell us that they're taking that Mac or iPad, the purchase that they're making through college, and they're bringing it into their first job. And so things that become incredibly important in that sense are, of course, durability, so the premium materials that are used in the design, and then, of course, battery life and performance. You want to think about the memory and storage needs that you, want to have large files open. You want to be using multiple apps at the same time. And Mac and iPad have an incredible combination that's really unmatched of all of those features. And so either of those products, the Mac and iPad product lines here at Apple are going to be tremendous for those needs to meet the journey. And then, of course, the unique integration of hardware and software at Apple. This is something that's going to provide performance improvements to your product over time and make that product experience even better. Integrating security and privacy, which are also fundamental to every product at Apple and will be fundamental to your journey as a college student and beyond as well.
You know, the other thing we want to talk about, 2026 has been the year of AI. That seems to be the only thing that people are talking about. How are students tapping into the power of artificial intelligence when it comes to school and their education?
AI is something that's going to be on the mind of many students and parents who are purchasing these devices. And the way we like to think about AI and a lot of technology here at Apple is it should be used effectively and intentionally. And if it is, then it can actually enhance that engaged learning experience and help students improve things like creativity, curiosity, and critical thinking, skills that are incredibly important to not only the learning experience and beyond. We build AI fundamentally into all of our products from the ground up, and features like Apple Intelligence are also built in. So Apple Intelligence is a whole suite of features that's designed to help you more seamlessly and productively move throughout your day. So for students, let's take a couple examples. In terms of taking notes in class, we have amazing Apple Intelligence tools like Summarize and like audio transcripts, which actually help you automatically take your notes for you so that you can better pay attention and focus on things like asking questions or being more creative in the classroom. There are other tools like writing tools. And so once you send a draft of that term paper, you can use it to edit and proofread that draft for you. So writing tools, it's kind of like a personal assistant or intelligence system built right into your device.
And so we'll let you get the plug in here. I know Apple has a back-to-school offer. Tell us about how families and, again, educators themselves can access education pricing.
Well, Apple has education pricing that's available to college students, their parents, educators of all ages, and including homeschool families, and that's available year-round. That includes many Apple products as well as services and accessories. And right now we have a special offer running through August 27th, and that will include both Mac and iPad eligible models. And with that, you'll receive a gift card of up to $100 to $150 to be applied through for a future Apple purchase. Now, examples of how students are applying that gift card could be AirPods, it could be Apple Pencil to use with iPad. And so we have those discounts available now and the special discount through August 27th.
Again, Colleen Novielli is Apple Director of Mac Product Marketing with us this morning. Colleen, where do we get more information?
Come on down to an Apple retail store. Again, we have a tremendous team of associates here to help get to know your needs and pick the product that's right for you. And if not, you can go to apple.com or search for the Apple Education Store online.
Colleen Novielli from Apple with us this morning. Colleen, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
In the news business, there are two separate and distinct groups: breaking news and the news that is already broken. These are their stories.
An alleged clothes thief in St. Louis was caught because the thief was wearing the victim's clothes. What a way to be undone. So this is the story. Nakia Huskin is suspected in connection with two home burglaries in the Dutchtown neighborhood of St. Louis. While the homeowner was waiting for police, they called the cops, waiting for police to respond. He noticed Mr. Hoskin walk by wearing his shirt and a pair of his daughter's pants. Or she was Nakia Hoskin is a she. Walked by his house wearing his shirt and his daughter's pants. When police did arrive, they arrested Ms. Hoskin. She was also suspected in another burglary, breaking into a house and then moving in, actually. So not just stealing clothes, but moving into a house. She had broken in two. She is being held without bond. And she's been given a new set of clothes. Her jail cell. That's bold. Break into a house, steal their clothes, and then walk by wearing their clothes. All right. Elsewhere in the broken news, two Florida men are accused of getting into a fight with a machete and a hatchet in a grocery store parking lot in Panama City. 52-year-old Everett Kirchbaum and 35-year-old James Gay were apparently arguing over a love interest. I don't know if she was worth it or not. Both men were taken to the hospital before they were arrested and charged. A fight with a machete and a hatchet. This turned serious very quickly. Authorities say Mr. Gay is the one that started the altercation. They say he also has a history of violence and has just recently been released from prison. So, boy, that's one lucky lady right there. They're fighting over her love. What girl wouldn't love to have people fighting over her? But maybe not like that. And finally, in the broken news this morning from the International File, Metropolitan Police in London seized 90 luxury vehicles valued at approximately $10 million over a single weekend, marking their largest haul since launching an anti-social driving crackdown 5 years ago. Officers targeted wealthy central neighborhoods, including Hyde Park, Kensington, and Chelsea, between Friday and Sunday. Offenses included loud engine revving, convoy cruising, and street racing. Authorities seized among the seized vehicles by authorities was a rare Ferrari Monza SP2. There are only 499 of them ever built. And this one was impounded. Is valued $5 million, that vehicle alone. And it was impounded. The car had been in the UK for only one day, was uninsured, and the driver was actually on a learner's permit. Apparently still with lots to learn. New authority allows officers to impound vehicles immediately without issuing prior warnings, said Special Chief Inspector Jeff Totman. We regularly hear from local people who are fed up with people driving their cars dangerously in the area, so we're just seizing the cars. No matter how much they are worth, 90 luxury vehicles valued at over $10 million now in the impound lot. You know, if you can afford to drive a million-dollar supercar, you really ought to be smart enough to be able to obey the traffic laws. I get it. You want to rev the engine of a supercar, but yeah, that's... There you go. That is today's broken news report, an update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
Most of us like to be out in the sun. That's why sunscreen and other safety measures are key to protecting your skin from aging and cancer. The FDA recommends using a sunscreen with an SPF of 15 or higher. Also, look for broad spectrum on the label. That means both harmful ultraviolet A and B rays are blocked. Remember, SPF plus broad spectrum equal healthy fun in the sun. Visit www.fda.gov/sunscreen for more information.
This message provided by WFIN.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. A new survey of 2,000 parents finds that 82% of families rely on one person to manage all meal-related duties. And guess who that one person is? In the overwhelming majority of cases, it's moms. 71% say that moms decide the weekly meals. 58% say dads. That actually adds up to more than 100, so I'm not sure how that works. But 71% of moms lead the role of managing all meal-related duties. Parents spend nearly 2 hours daily on dinner-related tasks, including not just planning, but of course cooking and then cleanup. 69% find it easier to handle meal planning alone rather than to delegate. So before you start thinking, oh, we've laid too much on mom, in most cases, well, 69%, moms would rather do this by themselves. Maybe it's one of that there's too many cooks sort of thing. More than half actually feel guilty when they are unable to provide a home-cooked meal for their families. But, you know, we're getting especially into the time of the year when things get real busy with back to school and all of the after-school activities. And before you know it, the holiday is going to be here, and that's going to add a whole other layer of complexity onto this. So even though more than half feel guilty when they're unable to provide a home-cooked meal, don't. 30% of the moms in the survey say that they spend 30 minutes or less of quality time with their children after preparing dinner. And then you get into this case of burnout. And yes, that is a thing. Meal burnout affects 23%, not burning the meal, burning out from having that responsibility. Burnout affects 23% of moms compared to 14% of dads. But of course, that's because generally they're the ones you, their responsibility falls to. Despite the pressure, though, 52% say they still find satisfaction in that role of meal planning for the family. And why not? I mean, there is quite a bit of satisfaction. I mean, you are literally keeping your family alive. You are literally keeping your family alive. But moms, don't feel guilty about that. It is tough. And all too often, it falls entirely to mom. But apparently, in most cases, she wouldn't have it any other way. Well, you check the calendar. We are less than 3 weeks away, just under 3 weeks from the Hancock County Fair. And of course, the Hancock County OSU Extension of 4-H programs getting all geared up, going full tilt, getting ready. Lauren Berner-Kitzler is with us from the 4-H program. And before we get to all of the preparations for our county fair coming up here in the not-too-distant future, seems like it's getting really close now, want to talk about the state fair, because we had a lot of local young people do very well in Columbus this year.
We did. So good morning, listeners. So yeah, exactly like you said, Chris, the Ohio State Fair, it's a whole new world down there. They have a lot of new expositions. They've got a lot of new construction happening and taking place to make it for a smooth experience for many families. But yeah, right here from our own county, we sent 80 non-livestock projects down alone.
Wow.
25 of those 80 received awards. 19 of those 80 received an Outstanding of the Day award, which is great for the project they went down for. But the best part is 6 of those walked away and coming home with a clock trophy representing our county. So very exciting. And that was just our non-livestock projects. That's not counting any of our livestock project members who also have gone down and attended and did very well.
Yeah, so. It is a terrific showing for Hancock County. And is that typical? I mean, in terms of how many kids will go down to the state fair? I mean, you know, in an average year, I guess.
So since I've started this position about 4 years ago, we've definitely increased those numbers, which is great because, again, if you have the availability to go and exhibit and show or just visit for a day of judging, you're going to see so much and getting to compete down there with other counties in the state of Ohio. It's an amazing feeling. And it's great that we have members that are doing that, not only on the non-livestock side, but as well as the livestock side. Cause I think truly that gets you to grow as a character because you're competing with the best of the best in the Ohio state
from all 88 counties. So
correct. Yeah. Yes. All 88.
It's certainly nothing to sneeze at to win at the county fair level, but to go to the state fair and compete and such a strong showing is truly impressive. So now we turn our attention to the Hancock County Fair. And like we said, preparations, you're going full tilt at this point.
We are. So the theme this year is American roots and country boots. So we're putting our boots on and we're digging into those roots. But something I really want to spotlight and share in preparation for that is every day in our Junior Fair Youth Pavilion building, 4-H and Family Consumer Science, our educator, Jennifer Little, we will be doing program in there every day. So it's all free to the public. So please stop out and come by. Kind of talking on my side of the fence for 4-H is each day we're going to take and we're going to break down the 4-H's. So our first day, Tuesday of the fair, kicks off that September 1st. We're going to be looking at the head. We're going to be putting our thinking caps on. We're going to be diving into different brain boosting challenges, STEM related activities, kind of transition into Wednesday, which is the heart. We're going to put our loyalty because it starts at the heart. We're going to spread kindness through focusing on friendships and being thankful, and then leading into Thursday with the hands, helping hands at work. So we're going to be doing a mini service community project around the fairgrounds and something that members can actually take away and do right there at home, whether you're in 4-H or not. Next up, we're going to be leading into that Friday, looking at the health aspect of it. So we're going to tie in our healthy living. We're going to get to explore the wellnesses and what is important about the mindfulness of our nutrition. Saturday, we're going to learn about all of them. We're going to tie all 4-H's together, doing a full celebration for all different kinds of ages, for youth that will walk through the building. And then we're going to wrap up on Sunday with our Clover Bud graduation. So this is what I'm truly excited for. Our Clover Buds, we have a great number of those. We have two phenomenal Clover Bud advisors. I'm going to give them a little shout out. Mary Ellen Stein, as well as Beth Marshall, they do a great job all year round supporting those Clover Buds. And then they get to come on Sunday and they get to graduate and they get to move forward into our 4-H program. So those that are not familiar with Clover Bud, this is kind of like that stepping stone of being a part of 4-H. You're still connected with our program, but you don't get to necessarily exhibit or do a project. But Beth and Mary Ellen do a really good job of making those Clover Buds feel a part of our program. So we're going to get to recognize around 32 members graduating from a Clover Bud program into our 4-H program. So very exciting.
And again, in preparing for the fair, we've said this time and time again, the youth program, participants are really the heart and soul of the fair, whether we're talking about the 4-H non-livestock products, projects that'll be on display in the building to all of the animals. I mean, literally hundreds of kids that are taking projects of some kind and showing them off at the fair. These are things they've been working on for a full year, you know, since last year's fair.
Yeah, so with our Junior Fair Youth Pavilion building, so that is a building that exhibits all of our members' hard work. So you're used to the livestock barns, which we love those members there, and you get to see physically their animals. But in that youth pavilion, we have FFA projects, we have art projects, and then we really spotlight those clubs. So we are fortunate we have 39 active 4-H clubs, and we will also have booths in addition to supporting Boy Scouts as well as Girl Scouts. And really, we just encourage families to walk through those buildings, take time to look deep inside of those fare booths, because again, a lot of these projects are held all year round,
right,
that most people don't think of, you know, right. They really think, oh, just the last few months of the year, but really it's something they've been working on almost a year ago today as we talk about it, you know, from picking those projects. But you get to see all of it on display, you know, from clothing to woodworking. You get to see the state fair participants, you know, with their clock trophies and all of their hard work as well.
Yeah. And learn a little bit more about what they've learned along the way in some of those displays. Now, we mentioned the projects they've been working on for months. The preparation for showing that off and displaying those booths, that's in full swing right now. And just think about that. I mean, you know, these kids are all preparing for back to school. They're, you know, getting ready for all of that, but they're also working on these booths with their entire clubs and, you know, how they want to display at the fair and all of that. There's a lot of work that just goes into that part of it.
There is. And like you said, many of our clubs are meeting, you know, right now on these weekends when there's availability before kids all start back to school.
Right.
But yeah, building their fare booths and putting those on display and how they want this and how they want that to make sure it looks very nice and presentable. And something else, kind of a perk for our clubs, is taking that theme, because most of our clubs, actually majority of our clubs, all design their fare booth around our fair theme that's picked by our junior fair board members. So like I mentioned, our theme is American Roots and Country Boots. So something else we also do in support of that is we actually have categories that our clubs can go up and kind of win, you know, best motion, best movement, best lighting. So all, yes, bragging rights. Absolutely. That's a great way to put it. So, I will say some of our clubs get very competitive, and it's pretty tricky for some of our judges who are selecting. But in all reality, it's good fun, it's good support, and it shows off that hard work that our members are doing each and every day.
And real quickly, because we're almost out of time, but one of, because you mentioned this, definitely want to get out give a shout out to the board members, the Junior Fair board members, who put in an enormous amount of time before and during the fair in making sure that everything goes off smoothly.
Absolutely. You know, those members, I think, you know, from the public side of things, if you don't know or not used to it, our senior fair board members, as well as junior fair board members, put a lot of hard work into making these 5 days of the fair something. You know, those junior fair board members are helping operate and run the shows. They're passing out the ribbons. They're giving out the trophies. So something that's not always seen, but a very well deserved and very important role as a junior fair board member. And so I will even also shout out to Britta Fenstermaker, who is the junior fair coordinator, doing a great job organizing and making sure those kids are all where they need to be and having those resources to be successful for the fair. So
absolutely. So again, going all out, full tilt, ready to go for the Hancock County Fair, now less than 3 weeks away. Busy time for Hancock County OSU Extension and 4-H. Lauren Berner-Kitzler with us this morning. Lauren, thanks very much for the update. We'll see you at the fair.
Thanks, Chris. Yes, see you at the fair. Have a good day, listeners.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program this morning. Remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the show at our webpage. That, of course, is goodmornings.net. And if you're a regular listener to the podcast, we would appreciate it if you would take a moment or two to leave us a rating or review on your favorite podcasting platform to help others discover the show as well. And we thank you very much for that. Coming up tomorrow on the program, Findlay City Schools Superintendent Dr. Andy Hatton will share his welcome back message to students, families, and staff as the new school year begins. So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.